Good morning. So, last week, Luther was covering, and we talked about the multiple issue out-of-order pipeline. So we had this new pipeline where we wouldn't actually execute the instructions in order. We kind of do the actual computations or reads and writes from memory as the operands became available. And to do this, we had this pipeline design where part of our pipeline was in order, meaning that, you know, assuming we didn't have branch mispredictions and things like that, we would execute instructions in the order that our original single cycle processor would. That was for like fetching instructions with prediction and doing this thing called register renaming, which was how we made it practical to do the bookkeeping we needed to do to figure out, you know, what thing can I execute now. And the key reason why register renaming worked is after we did this register renaming, our instructions were set up such that the registers used by the instructions were each written exactly once. So all we needed to track for each of these new register names was, have I written to this register yet or not? If I haven't, its value is not available. If I have, it is. And from that, I can take instructions as they're ready. How do I see if they're ready? I just check each of the registers the instruction would read and say, has it been written? If so, it's ready. And then we have this final part of the pipeline we didn't go into much detail about, where we commit instructions. This is also done in order. And this most notably is the answer to the question of how do we figure out what registers are free? You know, because otherwise we'd run out with this registry naming scheme. The commit stage is responsible for like looking at what instructions have actually finished and saying, oh, we no longer need this register anymore. And when we looked at that out-of-order model, we had to figure out, well, how does this actually execute programs? And how can we think about how fast our program will run given that? And one way of thinking about this is what we called a data flow graph, where we have a node for each operation, typically a downwards edge to represent data moving from one instruction to another. And we learned that one of the things we could do with these graphs is that if we see like our longest path from top to bottom, that's a latency bound, meaning that we have to do, you know, everything along that path to do our computation. And no matter how much parallelism we have, no matter if we have 1,000 ALUs, we still have to do one thing, then go down to the next, then go down to the next, and so on. And that's going to be a bound in our performance, no matter how, you know, wide our processor is. And similarly, if we look at the width of the graph, that gives us kind of an idea of the number of parallel operations we need to do to actually achieve that. And so if our graph is really wide, that probably means we can't actually, you know, do that on a processor which isn't actually that wide. Question? Or questions? The graphs that looked something like this? Yeah, it was just at the very end. As kind of a, this is why this works, but I'm just reviewing it in the other way. Yes?
Would it be possible to go over question 3 on the quiz?
Let me finish going over with last time, but then yes. Okay, so I'm talking about data flow graphs. You talked about them sort of at the very end last time. And one of the consequences of thinking of these things is that we learn about sort of two optimization patterns, where what we're doing is we're decreasing the depth of that graph. And one of these is what our textbook calls reassociation, where we just say, you know, reorder commutative operations so that we can, you know, have more things to do in parallel. You know, like, you know, if we're multiplying a bunch of values together, multiply pairs rather than one then the next then the next. And that's going to expose more things to do in parallel, and that's going to make our data flow graph shallower. In multiple accumulators, which is when we have a loop that's doing some sum or product or some other commutative operation, we can make that graph shallower, make it so we can do sort of two iterations of the loop in parallel by having different accumulator variables. And typically we do this in combination with unrolling. So we'd unroll the loop, and then we'd say, oh, now I have multiple uses of this sum or product or some other thing, which is accumulating values from different iterations of the loop together. Let's use different variables for them and resolve them at the end. So we, you know, when we're doing all the iterations of the loop, we could do multiple in parallel. And at the end, we'll have some serial stuff that meshes them together. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Someone wants me to go over a quiz, so I should probably prepare that. Did I miskey this quiz more? It seems likely. Let's see. So F is 10. Is this another case where I mixed up 10 and mixed up the two things next to each other? 10, which would be this R9. And I probably meant to write 7. Yeah, so I will fix that. But because then almost everyone got it right. Sorry. That's definitely, I adjusted the instructions for the question without adjusting my key. That's what happened. And other question? Yes? Number 2? Okay. Okay, so number 2 on our quiz was here. Okay, so this was asking about which would be the best candidate of an accumulator to split into two accumulators. And the way you'd answer this question is that it turns out that pretty much only one of these is actually an accumulator. So if we look at R10 here, some people wanted R10 to be this because R10's used a lot. And you said, oh, if we're using something a lot, that's going to be something we're going to do this multiple accumulators thing. But R10, we load a new value in it at the beginning of the loop, at one iteration of the loop, right? Because the loop goes from here to here. This is the loop. We do stuff with it. We do something with it to make it into R13, and then we never use it again. So R10 is independent for each iteration of the loop already. So it's not a sort of accumulator. We can do the multiple accumulators transformation for it. That doesn't make sense because it's a local variable in the body of the loop. And the same is true of R11 here. It's used for the subtract, and then it goes away, and we load a new version every iteration of the loop. There's nothing that's shared between different iterations of the loop. There's no dependencies between different iterations of the loop that we want to fix. So that's R10 and R11. And R13 is actually used this way. We add into R13 each iteration. So after we do loop unrolling, we might benefit from multiple accumulators. I would say, in this case, probably not, because for this loop to be faster with multiple accumulators, we need to be able to do loads. We need to be able to do more than 2 loads a cycle, assuming an add takes 1 cycle. If an add takes 1 cycle, you know, then in order for us to do 2 iterations of the loop in parallel, we need to do at least 3 loads in parallel. Which I don't think is a common yet, but maybe will be in the future. So the other possibility was RAX. RAX is our loop index. And I would say that it's less of a good candidate for that multiple accumulators thing because as our loop index, we have better ways of dealing with that in loop unrolling. When we do loop unrolling, we typically like adjust how much we're subtracting from it and so on. And we can like predict what the index is rather than need to like combine it at the end, which is sort of our multiple accumulators idea. So questions about that? Yes.
Only perform addition and subtraction, one only perform multiplication. I was wondering if we could possibly be rewarded partial credit under that.
I don't think so. But maybe, but definitely, I don't think that's a reasonable assumption, because the question says each capable of performing any arithmetic operation. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
So, partial credit will be decided when I have TAs reading the comments. So they'll look at comments, and I let them make the first pass of the key at a how many points we give. So that will be decided later. But I would say, I'm not really inclined to give a lot of points because of what the question says. Yes. Question, can I explain how we can use multiple accumulators without also doing loop when rolling? Generally, you don't. So you would generally only do multiple accumulators if you're also doing loop when rolling. Yes?
Can I go through problem four, please?
Problem four? Sure. So I have the schedule here that I would propose. And that's that this add and subtract are independent. So we can do them both in parallel. That's one cycle on our two ALUs. And then we can do this multiply, which is independent of this AND and XOR, on one ALU. And in the meanwhile, we can do the AND and then the XOR on the other. And while that multiply is going to take a long time to finish, the AND and XOR will finish while that multiply is finishing, while this multiply is still working. And so when that multiply finishes, that's when we're done. So the question is, how do you count the cycles? So one way we could think about this is we could try, where is my, I see what happened here. I definitely see what happened. Okay. That's the one I wanted to move over. Is we could sort of draw we have our ALU1 and our ALU2. So we're doing, I forget what the operations were, but we're doing our add and then we have our multiply. So this add is 1, our multiply takes 3, 4, 5, 6, and we're doing the whatever the remaining two operations, XOR and sub, I think. And if I draw that diagram, it's kind of clear. I count 6 cycles on that. No, because I'm just looking for what's the bottom, right? And the multiply is the bottom. Here. One of our sub Q is finished before the multiply, because time goes down in this diagram. Does that answer your question?
I'll keep on thinking about it. Thank you.
Okay. Follow-ups? I'm basically saying, so it's similar to the instruction dispatch diagrams we had where I assign something to each cycle. That's what I'm doing here. I'm just saying what's happening in each cycle, and I'm kind of glossing over whether the multiply is pipelined or not, but it doesn't actually matter for this question. Other questions? Okay. So a brief logistical note. So due to me screwing up configuration, it's possible a very small number, I think less than 2, but of Link ISA homework rewrites were lost. I looked at backups, but I think I have all of them, but I might not. So if there's a regrade that you submitted that's not reflected on the submission site now, contact me. I will fix it. And as you may know on the schedule, we have some homeworks coming up called Rotate and Smooth. Performance homeworks. These are individual only, but there's 2 of them, and that causes some confusion. So there's one which is to rotate an image, and one which is to smooth or blur an image, which has two parts. Part one of the second thing is do at the same time as assignment one. The weighting is that the rotate assignment is worth 75% of the homework, and part one of the smooth assignment is worth 25% of the homework. So they're still worth the total points of one homework. We just basically have the first homework is all of rotate and a little bit of smooth, and the second homework is the rest of smooth. For smooth, part two involves some optimizations we probably won't talk about until Thursday. But both of these deal with manipulating images, which are represented as two-dimensional arrays but that are flattened of pixels. So a pixel is going to be red, green, blue, alpha as a byte value. It's going to be this two-dimensional array similar to what we saw for matrix multiply, you know, that flattened representation. And the assignment is to take some original code we provide. For rotate, it looks like this. It just rotates an image, and you might say, wait a moment, what is this Riddick's thing? I'm going to talk about that briefly, because that's a common question. And this is a preprocessor macro that's defined in the code we give you, which basically ends up being shorthand for, if we look at this example here, for I plus J times dim. Wrong way. I times dim plus J. I times dim plus J. So preprocessor macros, the way they work, since you probably maybe saw this briefly in 2150, I don't know. So you can pound define things as that look like a function, and you can kind of use it like a function. So, you know, I say double of x is x times 2. So if I write double of x, it expands to, double of 100 rather, expands to 100 times 2. And it expands to literally 100 times 2, as if you wrote that code. And that is extremely literal. So if you write double of 3 plus 3, you'll get 3 plus 3 times 2, which is not 9. Which is not, yeah, not 12, but is 9. So what you'll typically see done when people define these macros is they'll put what looks like needless parentheses, but they're not actually needless. And the Riddick's macro we provide looks like this. Does it not? So this is what this assignment is derived from something our textbook authors made. This is something you'll commonly see in real C code. That's what that is. So it just expands to that. If you don't want to use it, that's fine. The goal of the assignment is to get something that runs faster and produces the same answer. We don't, for the most part, care about how you do that. We hope that the optimizations we've gone over will help you do that, but that's not the thing. In the assignment, you can submit multiple variants in one file. That's how it's going to work. We're going to grade on the best performance, so please don't delete stuff that works. I don't like hearing stories of, oh, I had this fast version, and then I, you know, added loop unrolling to it and got slower. Do you have the old version? No. Please don't do that. We're going to measure the speed up on my testing machine. So when you submit to the submission site, you'll get results on a web viewer with some delay. And there's a certain speed up threshold for full credit. It's my testing machine, maybe different than your machine, or maybe different than the department machines. Generally, I found that if you get some speed up on a machine with a similar compiler, which includes the department machines, you should get some speed up on my machine of a similar magnitude, but the details will be different. And generally, you know, try different things is how the assignment's going to work. Make sure you vary numbers. Like, just because loop unrolling doesn't work if you unroll twice doesn't mean it doesn't work, or if you unroll 1,000 times it doesn't work. Like, vary the numbers, and same things are sort of things like cache blocking or other things you might try. And remember that, you know, lots of things combine really well. Yes?
Can you
Yes, we will. That is in the assignment. We tell you what compiler we are using, and we also tell you the exact processor the testing machine has, I believe. Or the cache sizes the testing machine has. Maybe not the processor. Yes? So part one of smooth is due at the same time. So the difference between part one and part two of smooth is part one of smooth has a lower threshold than part two. We have, so rotate, we just say basically make it faster. We're not going to tell you much about how. For smooth, we have some very, very specific advice. You don't have to follow that, but I would recommend it. And for part one, there's a much lower threshold than part two, so you don't have to use some optimizations we're not likely to learn about until Thursday. So if you want to use them, that's fine. We're not going to stop you. Okay, so previously we were reviewing data flow graphs. Let's just do the first question here. So here I have a data flow graph for this assembly. My question is, what's the latency bound given the timings I have here? And this data flow graph, if you look, and hopefully I made it correctly last night, is produced by, just looking at every instruction. We represent each instruction, as one of these nodes, and we have its sources connected by lines. And for the move instruction, I divided it up into compute, address, and load, which is often something which happens internally in an out-of-order processor. Yes? Why does the move queue get? So the move queue gets, the move queue, we're computing, this is a move from an address that's computed by adding RBX and RDX into R8. So it has three operands in the assembly, but in our data flow diagram, it has two sources and one destination. Okay, who'd like some more time? A couple of people. Okay, so let's see. So who thinks we need at least 5 cycles? 6, 7, 8, 9. Okay, so we have a pretty good consensus on 8, which is what I get. So our longest path here is this one. And if we count up the number of cycles for each thing on the path, this is the latency. So by latency, I mean we might have a pipeline multiplier. If our multiplies take 3 cycles in a pipeline multiplier, that means that it's 3 cycles from when we start to when we finish a multiply. But maybe we could do multiple multiplies on that multiplier at the same time. That's not relevant to our latency. Yes?
How many ALUs are there in this situation?
So the question is, how many ALUs do we need? How many things do we need to do in parallel to actually achieve this? So that's a little complicated because if you remember how we talked about how a processor typically works, like typically we have a different execution unit for like loads than other operations. So like hypothetically we could like do some of these multiplies and adds that are independent. So this add here and this multiply, like we can do them at the same time as, and this add here, we can do at the same time as these operations, for example. So, you know, that looks like, so I think we could probably get away with like one ALU and one load unit and achieve that bound because of all the time we're waiting for the load. Assuming we have a pipelined ALU, so we can start one multiply each cycle. But I haven't actually worked out the details. And an advantage of these data flow diagrams is that we don't actually need to like write a schedule for when does each ALU get used to get a good estimate of what the performance is going to be. Yes?
So does the data flow diagram just show me which computations can happen at the same time?
The question is, does the data flow diagram just show you which computations can happen at the same time? Yes, that's essentially the important information we're getting out of it. Yes? Other questions? Yeah.
If two operations are at the same horizontal level, does it mean they're executed at the same time?
The question is, if two operations are at the same horizontal level, does it mean they're executed at the same time? No. It means they could be, but they need not be. So for example, in this example here, this add here represents our add of REX, REBX at the end. We can execute that any time after this prior add finishes. So we could execute it at the same time as this compute address, during this load, during this multiply, the same time as this add, because they're all independent of each other. So the depth in this, the way I've drawn it here, is basically kind of showing the earliest time we can do it, in some sense, but that's about it. Question, does this mean this processor has 3 ALUs? No, because this diagram we made without knowing what the processor was. Right, we'd have the same data flow diagram if this was, even if we were executing this on a single cycle processor. It's just that the latency bound would be less informative about what performance the processor could actually achieve. So there's a separate question of how many ALUs does the processor need to, you know, achieve our 8-cycle bound. Can it do it with just one? Does it need 3? And for that, we need more details that are like not going to be really apparent on this diagram. Like, for example, if the ALU is pipelined, right, maybe we could do it with one sometimes, and maybe not. And the way we figure that out is we work out that sort of what's in each cycle diagrams that Luther was showing you last time when we were doing instruction scheduling. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So the question is what assumptions should we make about how many ALUs there are? So you can typically look that up for a modern processor. Typical numbers for a modern processor are 4-ish for an out-of-order processor. I would say for doing optimizations, the big thing you want to look for is, can I get rid of long dependency chains? And you know, you should just assume that if you're doing something where you need to like have 10 ALUs for it to be faster, it's probably not going to get faster, right? Other questions? Okay. So our next topic is going to be we're going to talk about some more minor optimizations, but first we're going to talk about what compilers do. So compilers, you know, have options about optimization. So let's say you tell your compiler not to optimize. So if you tell GCC to just compile something and not optimize, it writes really bad assembly. Like, really bad. Like, this is not just, you know, we didn't think about optimizing it. This is, you know, if you were writing it as a human, you would say, what are you doing? Like here we're storing A on the stack. That's what GCC does without optimizations, typically. And we're loading it from the stack, the pointer A, every time we use it. And we're storing the result on the stack, and so on. So this is ridiculously inefficient. But we have optimization options, which can produce much better assembly. So I showed you the optimize for size code before of basically this. You know, that produces pretty intuitive assembly. And, well, GCC has options to not optimize for size. So if you use an old version of GCC with optimize level 2, it generates something where it said, oh, wait a moment. In this version, like we were doing this comparison at the top of the loop, let's just remove that and make the loop a little bit shorter by manipulating things to do the conditional jump at the bottom of the loop and having a special case for return 0. So it made the assembly a bit bigger and did this sort of very small optimization to remove one instruction. And compilers are really good at this sort of thing. And there's more optimizations they can do. So if you take a more recent version of GCC and ask it to optimize at level 3, the same code, it uses this weird p odd q instruction. It has a whole bunch of setup and teardown code. And p odd q is an instruction which adds two longs at the same time that are stored in these special registers that are 128 bits wide. We'll talk more about those instructions later, but it just generates this. It knows how to do it. So to do this, it's unrolled the loop twice and also turn the add into this special add two adds at once instruction. And if you tell it, oh, I'm working on a Skylake processor, one of the more recent Intel processors, not one of the old ones, it will even use a version of that instruction that adds four pairs of longs. And you can also tell it to unroll loops. And it will just do that. And Clang apparently likes unrolling loops even when you don't tell it to explicitly if you ask it for optimizations. So it generates this unrolled loop body. That's apparently unrolled 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Yeah, like 16 times or so. So you might say, if compilers can do all this, why do we bother teaching you like loop unrolling? Besides knowing what compilers are doing behind your back. And compilers are good at different optimizations than humans are good at. So loop unrolling is something they can do, but there's cases where, you know, loop unrolling is an obvious thing to do where compilers won't do it, and we'll talk about why. And there's some big limitations compilers have. One of them is that compilers need to generate code that does the same thing. And that doesn't sound like a real limitation. But oftentimes, when you're modifying code, you have some extra knowledge that's not explicit in the code. And we'll go through some explicit examples of that. Basically, there are corner cases where the compiler needs to make sure you get the same results that you don't need to worry about. So I guess one example in our prior loops is the compiler needed to handle, like, what if our n for that loop is negative, right? You as someone writing code would realize that shouldn't ever happen. But the compiler, well, you wrote code which said I less than n, it better make that work correctly when n is negative 2, because that's what the code says. And that's the compiler's job. It's not to second guess you. Yeah. Question for rotate, we aren't going to be using any compiler optimizations. We have chosen the compiler flags in such a way that certain optimizations are going to be done and certain are not. And that's chosen deliberately, yeah, to make the assignment work out. Another thing about compilers is that doing these sort of analysis for optimizations is kind of expensive. So compilers often try to analyze your code to do optimizations a method at a time. So often if you have some optimization that is between two different methods, they won't do it. One reason is just the performance impact of doing that. Another reason is that sometimes, you know, you'll have the code that calls the method in a different file than the code that, you know, where the method is. And if you think of our object files, well, the compiler has to generate an object file that doesn't depend on the code in that other file. So if there's some optimization that involves those two methods together, that can be very hard to do in that model. Another thing is the compiler can't predict what your values will be. So the compiler, you know, doesn't know that n's going to be a big number. It can guess, maybe, but that's just a guess. It doesn't really know, like, if a loop is going to have a lot of iterations or, like, 3. Another big thing is the compiler doesn't understand, as well as you might, whether you're okay with making your code really big. So you saw that some of these optimizations that the compiler was doing here are making what was a very short piece of code really long in assembly. And if we do that everywhere, that's going to be a problem. Okay, so let's first talk about probably the biggest pattern where compilers don't do optimizations you might expect because of corner cases where the code is working to do something and they need to do that. And this big example is something called aliasing. So here I have a function which takes two pointers to longs, and it looks like I just add 2 times the second long to the first one. And it seems like I should be able to do something like compile this into px equals 2 times star py. Like, that seems like something I should be able to do. That multiply by 2, I can do with loading once less from memory, and that should be faster. And here would be some assembly to do that. And this is assembly that is not legal for the compiler to generate because it is not the same function. You might say, wait a moment, but no, of course we're doing adding 2 times what py points to what px points to, but that's not what this function does because of a corner case. What if px and py are the pointers to the same thing? In that case, that would not be the effect of the function. So if x is 1 in this case, and I pass 2 pointers to x, I should get 4 and not 3. 3 is what I get by adding 2 times 1 to 1, but I should get 1 plus 1 equals 2, 2 plus 2 equals 4. So the compiler can't do that optimization unless it, like, has some way of proving that you're never going to call the function in this way. Yes? The question is, what does aliasing describe? Aliasing means that we have 2 different names for the same value. So in this case, our two different names are star px and star py are names for the same value, and that's what's causing the confusion here, is that the that you as a human think these are probably independent. The compiler can never make that assumption unless, like, you tell it somehow. The question is also possible that it gives a different overflow. So if you remember when we talked about undefined behavior with signed longs, it's undefined, so it doesn't matter. But even if it was unsigned longs, the overflow should be the same for the way we're doing the multiply by two. Okay, so this example of aliasing seems very contrived. You might say, this doesn't happen in real code, but it does. And as a less contrived example, here's a function that gets the sums of a bunch of rows in a matrix. And we have this result array, which is going to be the sum for each row, and a matrix. And this has an aliasing issue, which is that it might be the case that result of row is the same value as one of the indices into the matrix. It might be the case that we pass two pointers to the same to different parts of the same array through this function. You as a human know that seems pretty stupid. No one's going to do that. But the compiler doesn't know that. And that means that without some extra checking, the compiler can't keep this result of row in a register. Because if result of row is also part of the matrix, then it has to write it back in case it's going to read it again, read it back. Now, you can do something about this. You can help the compiler. So if you have a temporary sum variable, well, the compiler can know that that sum variable can't be part of the matrix because you never took a pointer to it. So we couldn't possibly have a pointer to it as part of the matrix. So questions about this example? So the second example, the compiler can know there's not aliasing. The first one, the compiler has to worry about that, even though as a human, you'd say, no one's ever going to call this function with two pointers to different parts of the same array. Yes? So what would the compiler have to do in order to account for the aliasing case? So the straightforward thing to do is that every time we modify result of row, we have to write it back to memory, just in case the place we're writing it back to is where we're about to read from the matrix. There's some less straightforward things the compiler could do. So the compiler could compare the pointers and see if they actually overlap and have different cases depending on that. But that's rarely done because it's kind of complicated to figure out when it's worth doing that. So I have these two versions of sum rows one, the one with aliasing, sum rows two, the one without. And if I compile this on an old version of GCC, it's probably similar in a new one, I get different performance. This scale here is cycles per element. And you can see I get a sort of improvement of performance with optimization level two, just from the compiler not writing to memory as much. And then with optimization level three, I got a bigger improvement in performance. I'd say, well, so what happened here? Well, remember I showed you that the compiler can do things like add multiple values at once? It figured out how to do that when there wasn't an aliasing problem. But when there was, it said, I don't know how I can unroll this loop and do multiple accumulator kind of stuff. I'm not going to do it. Okay, so questions? Yeah.
When you say it doesn't know how, are you saying that that's where the spikes are?
Question, is that where the spikes are? No. So what I'm saying it doesn't know how is that the blue version is the one with aliasing. The green version is the one without. So this is not about the spikes. The spikes are probably a measurement error in this case. Other questions? So this is showing that, yes, it really matters, you know, for the compiler to be able to eliminate this aliasing, because otherwise it, you know, has to do exactly what the code says, even though we know as humans that that doesn't really make sense. You don't really have to write every result row to memory, but that's what it says. Yeah. So the question is, what should we as programmers do? Should we try to eliminate aliasing? Yes, so making it easier for the compiler to see that there's not aliasing, there's not two names for the same value, should make it its optimizations work better. Gives it more freedom to, you know, figure out how to arrange the code, and usually that will end up being faster. Yes? I don't think I have, I guess I have a few extra prepared later on. So I mentioned that we can check the overlap. So let's talk about aliasing and cache blocking as another example. So here I have some sort of cache block code. And another question might be, can the compiler keep this value in a register? We're using it twice. We'd like to load it only once. Can it keep this value in a register? And because of aliasing, the answer is no. And the problem is that it might be the case that C and A are pointers to the same array. So in particular, let's say, you know, I times N plus K is 15. And C and I times N plus J is 20. And in that case, it could be the case that C is a pointer to five elements into A. If that were the case, then this here would be writing to this element of A. And that means that we couldn't reuse it later on. That seems incredibly unlikely as a human. We know that, but the compiler needs to worry about this. Because you wrote code that accessed the arrays in this way. That's what the code means. The compiler needs to obey that, even though we, as humans, know there's no way I'm going to make C and A be pointers to different parts of this big array. That's stupid. And so the compiler, in this case, can't just keep this element of A in a register, even though we're using it twice. Yes?
So then how
do
we solve this?
So the question is, how do we solve this? So the common sort of strategy is that you can help out the compiler by, you know, making a temporary variable when you want the compiler to reuse something in a register. That's one way you can solve it. There's some other possible solutions. There's some hints you can give the compiler, which some compilers might pay attention to say these two things don't alias. I have not found that they work very well. But there's a keyword called restrict, which is supposed to do that. I just haven't found it to do much in most compilers. But sort of the simplest way is that if you make temporary variables that are obviously that, the compiler can actually, you know, say, oh, well, of course, I know from the temporary variable that I must load this into a temporary value. Hopefully that's in a register, if you don't have too many of them. Yes? So the question is, do we ever have an aliasing issue when we're not referencing two variables that could be pointers to one value in the same line? So we could. So for example, well, I guess, you know, if we have some, if we're using, like, you know, so if this value was the one, was an alias to, like, if this was a different index here, right, we'd have to worry about whether it's written in between two reuses, right? So, like, here I'm using AI0K, AI0K. If this line does something to, you know, where that value would have been in memory, that's a problem. Or I should go back to our original example. So like, in between, if I want to reuse it here, if this line in between, or any of the lines in between, manipulated the value, we'd have to worry about that. So yes, we have to worry, even if it's not in one line. It's just like, when we're trying to reuse a value, in between those reuses, do we have a case where the value is gonna might be written under another name? Other questions? Okay. Let's do a little exercise on aliasing. So I have two versions of a function, one where I've done some sort of loop unrolling and reordering of operations that is not allowed. Thank you. Who'd like some more time? Maybe a little bit more. Okay, so who thinks our results could disagree for A? Okay, for B? Okay, for C? For D? Okay, so that is surprising given what happened last time I gave this exercise. And B is indeed, I think, the only example where the results would disagree. And the reason why they could disagree, so I have sort of this worked out, that if we work out how these accesses correspond to accessing A, for the first iteration we're doing A1 equals A0 plus A0, then A2 equals A1 plus A1. That's going to depend on the value we just wrote. For the second one, we're going to compute A1 plus A1 without that write. And that's going to be a different value. The other examples, we don't have this issue. So for A, because B is a different array, so there's no problem. We're only writing to B, we're only reading from A. For C, we are reading from A and writing to it, but we're reading from some place which is well beyond where we're writing to it, so there's no issue. So we're always reading values. We're always reading values that have not been overwritten yet in both versions, so there's no disagreement. We're reading the same values. And in D, we're reading values that will never be written because the bound is 1,000. Yes?
And there's like a version of D except those numbers like 500, 501 would then...
Question, if this was like a lower number, like 500 or 501, would we have a problem? And the answer is no, for the same reason C didn't, that in this case we'd be far enough ahead that we would never read values that we've written in either version. Yes?
Could you talk through your thought process of solving this problem?
Question, can I walk through my thought process? So the big thing I'm looking for is it possible that we can read a value we're writing in either case? And if so, would they disagree? In this example, all I need to figure out is, are we reading a value we're writing? So I could figure out that that wouldn't be true for either for A, C, and D, and so B was the only one I need to look in detail at. And the way I looked in detail at it is I just said, well, let's look at what a typical iteration of each of the loops looks like to see if we have those dependencies. And I just actually worked this out in this way. Yeah? The question is, what's the interaction between aliasing and dependencies? So aliasing is creating extra dependencies, right? Previously, you know, if we assume no aliasing, each of these di equals s1i plus s2i is independent, right? But because of aliasing, they can be dependent on each other. And that's why this transformation that we tried to do here didn't work, right? This transformation is fine if there's no dependencies between each of the DI lines. But if there is, it's not. And that's often something the compiler would like to know for its optimizations, that these two things are independent, I can move them around wherever. But when it can't do that, that's going to make it give it a lot less options. Question?
Yeah, would it be fair to think of like the problems caused by aliasing being analogous to the problem
Question, would it be fair to think of aliasing problems being similar to load use hazard? I guess. Kind of. The same solutions don't work, really, for aliasing. So, but, yeah. Yes, it should.
So then in the line below, would it be A or 0 with this temp point and A plus 1?
Remember that D is A plus 1 because of our setup. Okay. So aliasing also tells you an answer to, we showed you that like you can't do optimizations, so we showed you that it couldn't like do register reuse in our sort of example cache block code. Another thing aliasing means the compiler can't do is it generally can't do cache blocking for you. Because to do cache blocking, it needs to do some extra work to either show that aliasing isn't happening or like add some if statements. Oh, if A and C and B overlap, do something else, otherwise do the cache block version. And this is why probably if you want cache blocking to happen, you need to do it yourself. Because the compiler's not going to know that these two loops are equivalent, because what if C and A and B are parts of the same array? Yes?
If you go to the previous slide, can you just explain again why, so in the top part, like the A of 1 equals A of 0, A of 0, and then the next line, how could that create a difference?
So, this is, like, I just showed you what the code, that body, loop body for I equals 0 equals 1. So in this example, when we're writing to D of 0, we're also writing to S1 of 0. S1 of 1, rather, sorry. So that means that that's going to be a different value than here, where I'm reading from A1 before it gets written. Like, I'm still writing the same number of times, just in a different order.
You'd be writing that A1 in the second line up top?
And up top, I'm writing A1 in this first line here. And in the second version, I also write A1, but I only write it after I already read A1, which is not the order I did things in the first version. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, why did I choose these two different versions? Well, this is going to be very related to an optimization called vector instructions we'll learn later. This is a transformation the compiler would really love to do. Okay, so we talked about aliasing and revealed that this is a reason we can't do, why compilers often won't do cache blocking for you, because, you know, that often means they can't. So there's some different reasons which apply to some other things, like loop unrolling. So loop unrolling, you might say, why doesn't the compiler just do it for me? It's actually a very, very mechanical transformation. It's very easy for the compiler to do. And the biggest reason is that the compiler can't tell when loop unrolling is helpful. Because if we do too much loop unrolling, we're going to get these big executables, we're going to have lots of instruction cache misses, things are going to run slower. We only want to do loop unrolling for loops that are actually executed a lot. We don't want to do it for things which aren't executed much. We'll just make lots of extra instructions that mostly aren't run. And when the compiler sees a random loop, you know, you can't really tell if it meets that criteria. Is some variable typically like 2? Is it 1,000? Is this some function something that is worth like having a unrolled loop for? Or does that take like a second? So it doesn't really matter how fast this loop is. The compiler probably can't figure that stuff out statically. So typically it makes conservative guesses about when loop unrolling is worthwhile, and won't just unroll any random loop. It will unroll some, but you know, if it doesn't know that the loop actually executed a lot or that the loop body is very simple, it's probably not going to bother. Also, in some cases, the compiler might have trouble figuring out you know, how to enroll. So like if our loop bound is like a global variable, you know, it's actually a little tricky to figure out how to enroll the loop. And we have the same kinds of issues for multiple accumulators. Multiple accumulators are going to use extra registers. That's going to have less registers available for other things. And they're often not worthwhile if the loop isn't executed much, you know, or if other stuff in the loop is going to be more overhead than the running sum. You know, the compiler probably won't do that for you. So that's why, sort of, even though loop unrolling is super mechanical, and multiple accumulators, in many cases, is very a mechanical transformation that compilers could do, they often just don't have the information to know whether it makes sense to do it in any particular case. So it's often something that you can get some benefit by doing yourself, or at least telling the compiler when to do it in some way. One way you can tell it is by just, you know, manually unrolling the loop. There might be other ways in some compilers. So, for our last topic today, probably our last topic, we're going to talk about one other sort of kind of optimization. And this is dealing with a common case here. I have a loop where I have a function call to this add with limit function. This is a nice simple function. It just adds, see if it's greater than 1,000, so clamps it. And if we think of how this loop gets compiled, the straightforward way to compile it would be that we'd set up this function call, we'd, you know, set up the arguments, and then we call, and then use the result in REX. And this means that we're executing 1, 2, 3, 4 instructions that we probably wouldn't execute otherwise. And, you know, for a typical function call, that's not a big deal, right? We have call and a return and some set instruction set of arguments. Not a big deal. But in this case, this function is actually really simple, right? This function is probably like 2 or 3 instructions besides that setup. So we're like doubling the cost of running this function. I guess probably more than 2 or 3, probably like 3 or 4. Sure. But it's almost doubling the cost of running the function. And what we'd like the compiler to do is what we call inlining the call. We'd like it to say, rather than having the call here, we'll just move this code into here and get rid of the function call and return. That's what we'd like the compiler to do. And this is called inlining. We're taking the out of line, the somewhere else code of the function, and putting it in line inside the loop where it's being used. So this is something that compilers do, and we could also do it by hand. Like so. So inlining is great. So it avoids these extra instructions, allows us to use more registers, but it's not always good. So one reason it's not always good is that, well, we have more instructions. So in this example, we wouldn't have more instructions, but if we think of a program where that add with limit function is used in lots of places, you know, if we inline it everywhere, we have, you know, 10, 20, 30 copies of add with limit versus one. So if we do this too much, it's going to be bad. We're going to have our program is going to get bigger. We're going to run out of instruction for that space. It's going to run slower. So compilers do this inlining thing because it does make our code faster. And inlining is really useful also because it exposes other optimizations. So one big example is inlining means we have more registers available. I don't have to free up the caller saved registers. I don't need to move things into arguments. So it often makes other optimizations faster. But, you know, if we do it too much, it's bad. So compilers usually have some guesses about when inlining is worthwhile. And typically, the big guess they make is that there's some threshold where we're going to assume that it's going to make the code too much bigger to inline if the function's too big. So typically, the heuristics are, if the function's too big, don't inline. With an exception, if the function's called exactly once, maybe inline it. And the other bigger issue is the compiler can't inline across object files. And the reason why it's not is pretty simple, is that, you know, if I have one version of my add with limit.o, I could replace it before I make my executable with some different code. And that different code better appear in my executable. So if the compiler is doing linking the kind of way we learned about, it can't really do inlining if it's in a different file. It doesn't know whether that file is going to change before we make the executable. So inlining, you know, can improve performance a lot. And I would say something to note is that sort of often a bigger reason why inlining improves performance than removing the overhead of the function call is because it exposes more optimizations you can do. So for example here, you know, if we wanted to do something about realizing maybe we can do the sum greater than 10,000 outside of the loop, we need to inline before we can do that. Right? You might say, wait a moment, we don't actually need to check that every iteration. If you wanted to do that, or if you wanted your compiler to do that, you need to inline first. Or if you wanted to do something with multiple accumulators in sum, you need to inline first to find that, right? Otherwise, you can't really know that that's going on. But it's challenging for your compiler to do it in all the cases you want, especially because of separate compilation. So I guess I note that compilers have sort of two kinds of fixes to work around these issues. So one is that compilers often have a way of specifying in your code, please inline this, or please don't inline this, which may or may not help. Another thing is that there's something that some compilers support called link time optimization, where rather than having object files contain the actual machine code, they'll have them contain something where they can do inlining before producing the executable. Obviously, this means that linking is a lot slower if you do that. Like, a lot slower. Like, 10 or 100 times slower, probably. But if you want higher performance, that's something people will sometimes do in making, like, an executable to ship. And I think one minor thing to do, but I think for time reasons, that's where I'll finish up today. We'll talk about a few miscellaneous optimizations next time, and then go on to talking about vector instructions.